Rabies is almost fatal if it's untreated, but today it's pretty rare, at least in this country. It's been a scourge for humans for millennia, and it's even spawned some of our most popular mythical monsters. On this week's installment of Please Explain, we're finding out all about rabies, and joining us are veterinarian Monica Murphy and journalist Bill Wasik, authors of Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. It's published by Penguin, and I thank you both so much for coming on our show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And we're also taking listener calls. You can call us at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Bill, you call rabies the most diabolical virus. Why? Why is it? What is it about rabies that makes it diabolical or more diabolical than other viruses?
Well, you know, rabies is one of those rare diseases that actually sort of possesses the host, thinking of animals in particular, and sort of causes them to spread the illness. So, you know, it'll take an animal that normally either will be very friendly to humans in the case of a domesticated dog, or would typically avoid humans like a fox or a skunk or a raccoon or that sort of thing, and it will sort of warp their mind and turn them into essentially, you know, attacking creatures whose only goal is to spread the virus.
And Monica, they spread it by biting us?
That's right. The virus is shed in the saliva, and so when an animal bites, it gets the saliva down under the skin where it can interact with nerve cells and begin the slow crawl to the brain where it does all of its damage.
It's zoonotic. What does that mean?
Oh, that just means that it can be transmitted from animals to people. And we know today that lots of diseases fall into that category. In fact, most fall into that category, things like flu and SARS. But back to more ancient minds, rabies was the real obvious one. You have a mad dog, bites a human, and weeks or months down the line, you have a mad human.
Are there any similar diseases?
Well, rabies is pretty special in its biological behavior. You know, it's just in that it relies on the bite for transmission and that it travels in the nerve cells rather than the bloodstream. So it's pretty special in that respect. But you know, like I mentioned, in terms of being able to get from animals to people, we know now that most important human diseases, and especially of the new emerging diseases like HIV or the new MERS virus in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere on the Arabian Peninsula, those viruses have their origins in animal populations. And it's when they find a way to spill over outside those populations, make the jump into people, it can cause a lot of damage among us.
Well, Bill, as Monica pointed out, the animals infected with it become hyper-aggressive. In fact, I guess the image we have is that they're foaming at the mouth. Do humans become hyper-aggressive?
Not in the same sort of way. So one question that we get a lot is, do humans want to bite people in the same way that animals do? And as far as we can tell from the literature, there are some cases of humans, you know, becoming aggressive in a biting way. But for the most part, people will become aggressive in more human ways. They'll yell. They'll convulse. Sometimes they'll attack people. It's pretty grisly, but it's not quite parallel to what you see in animals.
Can you explain hydrophobia, the fear of water that someone with rabies suffers from?
Well, sure. It's you know, as with animals, you know, what the rabies virus is doing is it's ratcheting up salivation, and in the meantime, it's making it difficult to swallow so that the saliva stays in the mouth. So the way that manifests in humans is there's this inability to swallow, and so even if you feel thirsty when you're in the sort of, you know, deadly throes of the disease, someone will present you with something to drink and you'll just physically feel a revulsion to it because your ability to swallow has been impeded.
Monica, you said that it attacks the nervous system. How does it work?
Well, the virus actually, once it gets inside a peripheral nerve at the site of the bite, slowly works its way up from the peripheral nerves to spine into the brain, and once inside the brain causes damage to the limbic system, which is the primitive part of the brain that controls fear and aggression, which is how those behaviors we've been talking about get brought out by the virus. And ultimately, it'll kill the patient by shutting down vital brain functions.
Is it always fatal if it isn't treated?
Well, until recently, it was believed to be 100% without exception fatal in humans. And in recent years, we've seen that the needle budge a little bit. It's now believed to be fatal 99.9% of the time, or, thereabouts. We've seen a few survivors, mostly young people, and often young people who are being treated very intensively in the hospital. Some of them have had comas induced and have come through as survivors. But we've also seen at least one case of what appears to be rabies in a young person who never was put in intensive care, but yet developed antibodies to the virus and had a history of contact with bats, an important vector species, and developed signs consistent with rabies. And so we're learning, partly through better testing and paying more attention, that rabies is in rare cases survivable. But still, if you get rabies, there's no reason to be optimistic.
My guests are Monica Murphy and Bill Wasik, co-authors of Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. It's published by Penguin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you mentioned bats, and I also think of dogs when I think of rabies. Do we know which were infected first, where this began?
There are studies that have shown that it likely made the jump first into bats and then later into dogs.
And can cats also transmit it? Squirrels, raccoons, beavers?
Well,
rats?
The rabies virus has adapted to certain species so that the animals are able to live with the virus long enough to be likely transmitters of the virus. And globally, the most important of those is the dog strain. That's responsible for most human infection around the world, about 99% of it. Bats have strains unique to bats, and certain wildlife species do too, like raccoons, foxes, and skunks in this country. Animals like squirrels and cats, like all mammals, can get the virus. Cats in particular, since they tend to find all the sick bats we have lying around, can potentially become rabid and be vectors of rabies. But most animals, like squirrels and other herbivores, and us, for that matter, are pretty much dead-end hosts of rabies. Even if they get rabies, not real good at transmitting it on to somebody else.
Could you?
But it is important to add that cats, for listeners out there, the cats, it's very important to have your cats vaccinated against rabies. We've actually gotten to the point in a lot of places where cats get rabies more frequently than dogs, simply because people know, they're supposed to vaccinate their dogs, but they often, won't do it with cats, and that can be a problem.
Can you spot if an animal's been affected, other than if they're foaming at the mouth?
Well, yeah, I think it's important to know that they don't always look like that fictionalized Cujo that we all imagine, when we're thinking of rabies. Cats especially can be really sort of cryptic in their signs when they are rabid. Often they'll just seem sort of depressed and not hungry. Wildlife might be more visible or might, be more willing to be seen in daylight, but sometimes a wildlife have adapted to suburban living, and they're just willing to be seen in daylight. So it can be sort of confusing to determine just by looking whether an animal might be rabid, which is why people who are bitten by animals should report to those bites to their local health departments and let them sort out whether those animals are rabid.
In talking about it, I'm struck by the popular phrases that come out of this, foaming at the mouth, can be applied to humans, not literally. We talk about people having rabid fans.
One of the inspirations, behind this book was, the idea of doing a cultural history of rabies was sort of the observation that we use the word rabid, I mean, which I mean, frankly, refers to just one of the most horrible ways that a person can die. But we use it in these references to rabies in all of these other contexts, both to talk about anger or, as you point out, to talk about love and enthusiasm. And what's fascinating as you get into the history is that you have that pattern replicate itself throughout history in many different languages. So, for example, our word rage itself comes from the French word for rabies. Similarly, in ancient Greek, the word lissa, which is the medical term for rabies, also appears in the Iliad. It appears in various tragedies as this kind of insensate animal anger that will kind of descend upon a hero and cause him to, you know, commit terrible acts of violence.
What are the earliest references to rabies?
Well, there are references to rabies in Sumerian texts. I mean, so going back, you know, thousands of years. There's something called the Laws of Eshnunna, which were a sort of precursor to the Code of Hammurabi, that talk about what the penalty is if someone's, you know, dog becomes rabid and results in the death of a person. You know, how many shekels you have to pay in recompense. You see it there in an ancient Greek. There are some ancient Indian medical texts where it appears. It's really basically there throughout the whole history of human writing.
Let's take a call from Michael from Brooklyn. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, I have one question. How accurate has rabies been? Has rabies been shown on television, media, movies, things like that? Like, I remember one rather powerful episode on the show Scrubs with Zach Braff, where a woman had rabies and she ends up giving it to her other patients through an organ transplant. And I mean, that was a rather atypical episode because it was kind of like a story, a plot point. But I just want to know, how else has it been used in television, movies, and how truthful has it been? How real has it been?
And can you get it from an organ transplant, Monica?
Yes. Unfortunately, there was a case in the news just this past week about a rabies case in a Maryland man from a transplanted organ. It turned out that the organ donor, whose death was not understood to be rabies at the time, had organs harvested and distributed to a few different individuals. The man who died in Maryland was more than a year out from his transplant, which makes it a very unusual case. And they did, though, find the other people who'd received organs from the donor and vaccinate them. And to date, they have not gotten rabies, which is definitely good news. Rabies through organ donation is certainly unusual, but it's unfortunately, something that's been recorded a few times over the last several years. You know, the need for organs is great, and rabies is exceedingly rare, and screening every donor for rabies has so far not proven to be a cost-effective. I mean, not that you can put a price on human life, but just trying to get those organs out to the people that need them, it seems like it'll slow down the process without a lot of benefit. At least that's the judgment that's been made by the experts to date.
Gary from Port Washington, New York, left this comment on our show page. Can rabies spread through shared water bowls between animals? If you get rabies shots for your pet, how long is that vaccine good for? And are there rabies shots for people, especially people who work in animal hospitals?
Yes, I can answer those questions. Fortunately, sharing a water bowl is not a risk factor for rabies, because even though rabies is shed in the saliva, it needs to enter under the skin to interact with that nerve cell to transmit rabies. So we don't advise sharing water bowls with rabid animals, but it is not very risky compared to any sort of biting contact. The vaccine in animals protects them for as many as 3 years, although that depends both on the individual vaccine, where the animal is in its life course, because the first vaccine and the second vaccine are given closer together, and also your state laws. And finally, for people, absolutely. I mean, The sort of greatest milestone in rabies treatment was the development of the post-exposure vaccine for people by Louis Pasteur back at the end of the 19th century. But we do have pre-exposure vaccines as well, meaning vaccines that can be given before you have an opportunity to be bitten by a rabid animal. And they are used in people who work in animal hospitals and in other high-risk occupations like dog catchers or laboratory workers in rabies labs, or even some travelers who are heading out to remote locations where there's a large number of rabid dogs.
And I want to talk about that post-bite vaccine after we take a little break. Unfortunately, I was one of the people who was given it, at least four shots. It was one of the most painful experiences of my life when I was a kid. Monica Murphy is a veterinarian. And her husband, Bill Wasik, is a senior editor at Wired. They have collaborated on a book called Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. It's published by Penguin. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, who have co-authored a book called Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. It's published by Penguin. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go to a call from Stuart from New Jersey. Hi, Stuart.
Yeah, hi, Leonard. I have a question for your guests regarding first use of the vaccine in the United States. I understand the family story is that my great-grandfather, Dr. William O'Gorman in Newark, New Jersey, had five young boys who were bitten by a rabid dog, and he raised funds to send them to France by steamer, I guess. And I don't know if your guests know if anything about that particular instance, or if they might want to shed some alternative light on first use stories of the vaccine by Pasteur here in the U.S.
Well, William O'Gorman is in your book, isn't he?
He is. It's a great story. It was. I can't verify that it was the very first use of the vaccine in the United States. You know, the vaccine was starting to be known in the U.S., and I think people were, you know, singly under their own resources traveling to Europe to be vaccinated when they had a dangerous exposure to a possibly rabid animal. But it's a really important story in how the virus sort of captured the popular imagination in the United States and turned some skeptics into believers in the power of vaccines.
It took a long time to get to Europe in those days because there were no airplanes. So if a transatlantic steamer got you there in 6 or 7 days, wouldn't you be really sick by then?
No. Fortunately, there's a long latent period between when the rabid animal bites and when the virus makes that deadly crawl up the nerves into the brain and starts to cause disease. And that lapse, that time between when the bite occurs and when the person becomes sick with rabies, that is the time in which you can use the post-exposure vaccine. So once the signs develop, there's nothing that can help you. Or there wasn't until the last several years when more intensive care and induced comas have started to come into use. But that time between the rabid bite and the first signs of rabies, any time in that window, vaccine can potentially stop the virus and save the victim. So the several days that were necessary to travel to Paris, to the Institut Pasteur to receive the vaccine, I'm sure were very tense because, you know, they are very worried, probably about the more severely bitten children that the signs could appear at any moment and then the vaccine would not be useful. But all the children, as it happened, you know, made it to Paris and were vaccinated by Pasteur, and they all believed that their lives were saved, and their community, who had raised the money to send them, were just, you know, so happy. And it was well publicized in newspapers in the greater New York area and around the country. It was actually a syndicated story that readers, you know, in the Midwest and the American West were reading too. So it was after that that Pasteur Institutes started to pop up around the U.S. and the vaccine started to become more widely available.
Well, we mostly associate Louis Pasteur with pasteurization of milk. Did this come first, or did his pasteurization process come first?
Pasteurization came first. Pasteur was trained as a chemist, and he sort of moved into food science and fermentation and then pasteurization, which got him thinking about wound contamination and asepsis and keeping patients safe from developing infection. And that was sort of his in to infectious disease. He started developing vaccines for animal diseases first, and rabies was his only human vaccine, but it was the beginning of the modern vaccine era. The only vaccine that predated rabies was the smallpox vaccine, which was essentially taking a folk remedy that had been in use for some time of exposing people to a low level of the disease or a similar disease in animals.
Right, exactly,
to protect against smallpox. But Pasteur's vaccines were vaccines made from laboratory attenuated organisms. So he took diseases into his laboratory and, using a variety of methods, aging them or treating them with chemicals, weakened them so they produced an immune response very deliberately that might protect against infection with the wild type organism. And so that's kind of the basis for all the vaccine technology that followed. And it all started in his lab. He chose rabies, actually, to debut his technology in humans because it was such a fascinating, scary disease that even though it didn't affect a lot of people, even when it was at its worst, it terrorized them. It filled the headlines, you know, rabid dog rampages this neighborhood, 6 children bitten, you know, and parents just waiting, counting down the months to see if their kid would develop the fatal virus or not.
Richard from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Great show, thanks. Yeah, I had rabies shots when I was a kid back in the early 70s, and it was 14 shots in the, in the belly, and 3, like, couple boosters in the arm, I think, and a tetanus shot. Now, are those shots still good with me?
You could get titers checked and see, but because you have a vaccine history, if you did have the misfortune to run into another rabid or suspicious animal, you'd be treated differently than someone who'd never been vaccinated before. But I also want to mention for listeners who've never been vaccinated before, the vaccine protocol these days is a bit kinder than the one that this listener was exposed to.
Yeah, Richard, I had only 4 shots until they found out that the dog that had bitten me was not rabid. I was was in elementary school, so I was still fairly young. A dog bit me on the way to school. It was probably the most painful experience I've ever had in my life.
Oh, no.
or up there, anyway.
I had to get a shot every day for 2 weeks.
Yeah. I was crying constantly as my father took me to the clinic. Was it really bad for you?
Yeah, it was miserable. Even to this day, I don't like needles. But I was in second grade.
Yeah.
And I remember asking, when we were looking for the dog that bit me, and I remember asking, like, well, can't we do some tests and see if I need to get these shots first? And then that's what you were just talking about a minute ago, is that it would be too late.
Well, why does it have – is it still that painful today? Have they made it any – have they modernized it anyway, come up with a better solution?
Yes. In fact, the current vaccine recommendations are just 4 shots to the upper arm over 2 weeks. So that can be combined with a immunoglobulin treatment at the site of the wound. I think, you know, people who are bitten these days, that's the part of the treatment they loathe the most, having the immunoglobulin injected to try and neutralize virus right where the animal bit. But the vaccine itself, you know, is not really significantly worse than the other vaccines we get for tetanus or what have you, and so it's a lot less traumatic, I think, for victims who are getting bitten right now.
Now, Bill, we mentioned earlier that the ideas of vampires and to some degree zombies have a connection to rabies. Did people think that they would turn into bats if they were bitten?
Well, it wasn't quite as, I wouldn't say the cultural, you know, lineage is quite as direct as that. I mean, what's interesting about all these myths, I mean, the vampire myth, the werewolf myth, and the zombie myth, is that they all sort of have their roots in myths that are not all that similar to rabies. You know, I mean, the original vampires, you know, back in the 17th century were, you know, they tended to, you know, they'd sit on your chest in the middle of the night and they'd scratch at you, and if they bit you, they might sort of bite you on the chest. And more importantly, you know, these conditions in the original myth were not necessarily seen as contagious, and that's certainly true with the vampire myth and the werewolf myth. What you see with the vampire myth in the 19th century, you know, as there's sort of in conjunction with sort of urbanization and the rise of the middle class, and these incredible hydrophobia panics, you know, in London and Paris and other big cities, is you start to see with the birth of vampire literature, the vampire becomes sort of more and more rabid, you know. So his teeth kind of physically, you know, he starts to get those canine teeth. It starts to become a communicable infection. You know, there's also this sort of interesting kind of sexual undercurrent to some of these rabies stories. And similarly with, or to some of these vampire stories, and similarly with rabies, one kind of aspect of the symptoms, which is true, not necessarily common, but you start to see surface in the medical literature about rabies in the 19th century, is that there's actually a hypersexuality dimension to a significant percentage of rabies cases, where you can have sort of essentially uncontrollable, you know, sexual impulses. You have, you know, arousal, orgasm, and that kind of stuff. I mean, you start to see that appear in the symptomatic literature. And so, the way I sort of like to think about it is, it's not so much that these myths develop specifically from rabies, but it's that there's this kind of animalistic kind of nature infecting the human, which has sort of animated the cultural response to both of these things over the years.
Although it is interesting that we're seeing a revival of these things, lots of vampire and zombie movies, and then today we had the equivalent of a werewolf movie opening up. So I guess it goes. We go through cycles, even though we don't have very many rabies. But we do have somebody who was bitten by a rabid raccoon on our show. Les from Hastings. Hi, you're on the air. Les, you're listening to us on the radio, and we are on delay. So go to your phone.
I'm sorry, sir.
You're on the air. Turn off your radio, okay?
Hello?
Yes, go quickly.
Hi, you on here? Oh, hi.
Go ahead, Les, please. We have very little time.
No, okay. No, I have you. I turned the radio off. I just wanted to make a comment because I did have I had an encounter with a raccoon over this last year in my house. It was attacking my dog. And what happened was I went into the path of it. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was just wearing shorts. And he basically just started mauling me, and all the things you hear about in the movies. I mean, this thing was really a Tasmanian devil, and the more I tried to push him off, the more she kept coming at me.
Do you know if the raccoon was rabid?
And so it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was either me or the raccoon. So I ended up having to kill the raccoon. And I had her tested the next 2 days later, and she was rabid. There was no exaggeration about their behavior and how this, pretty obvious how this virus is transmitted now, you know, that's how it perpetuates itself. But I did want to say that I am a veterinarian, so I was vaccinated, you know, back in the late 80s. And the booster, the vaccine is perfect. I mean, it's amazing. There's never been, I spoke to people, I forget where it was, in Texas or Minnesota, and there's never been a case of anybody who's in Kansas, and there's never been a case of anybody who's been who's been vaccinated ever coming down with rabies. So it's really a fantastic vaccine.
Well, Lars, thank you so much for calling us. We've run out of time. But my great thanks to all of you who've called in and written, and especially to the two contributors today to today's Please Explain segment about rabies, Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, whose book, Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus, is published by Penguin. On Monday's show, Andrew Meyer on why Mayor Bloomberg's 12 years in office may be the biggest issue in this year's campaign. And then Lily Coppell looks at the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts who became national celebrities as their husbands launched into space. And then the working and personal relationship between choreographer George Balanchine and his childhood friend, ballerina Lydia Ivanova. And we will also find out how coastal communities from Maine to Miami are adapting to rising sea levels and the threat of flooding. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Casey Dalrymple, Ankita Sood, and Helen Rauner. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.